Good morning. This is Rob Reed, author of After On and host of the After On podcast, and you are listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Scrolling for June 2nd, 2020. I'm Steve Foner.
I'm Chip Hassenflow.
Yeah, we're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. And if you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. Let's get outside. Let's visit. Let's stare at each other from a distance and air high five each other, Chip. I am done with this being cooped up thing.
Well, let's just not burn things, Steve.
Be a good solution to the problem. Let's not set the city on fire. Cities across the country, let's not do that this weekend.
Yeah, certainly protests were going on. Hopefully there'll be some answers to that shortly.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with protests. It's when the protests turn to other activities other than making a point that I was troubled this weekend.
Down, get my film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. I have seen quite a few things this week, Chip. I finally got, time with no school and all, and summer school coming up. And I watched Space Force on Netflix. This is a 10-episode series featuring Steve Carell from the mind of Greg Daniels, you know, the guy that made The Office, and Steve Carell shined in that so much. They are now poking a little fun at the political landscape and the concept of the Space Force.
So tell me a little bit about what this show is about.
It is very similar to The Office in that it is a very silly, ridiculous comedy with a leader in Steve Carell who is usually pretty good at his job, but occasionally he makes decisions that are pretty inept.
Is this a mockumentary?
It is not that mockumentary style. It is a standard dramatic style. There's no mockumentary. He's staring into the camera later to explain what he was thinking piece to it. But it is laugh out loud funny at parts. It is completely ridiculous at other parts. The work of Steve Carell is right on. He does have his moments where he really truly cares about his job, about the people around him, about what he's doing. And then he has those moments where he's making decisions that are ridiculous to everybody around him. It's a really good mix of those.
Is this the United States Space Force? Is this present day? When does this take place?
Yes, this is present day. This is mocking the concept of a space force as opposed to an air force. In fact, the first scene is the creation of Space Force and the nomination of Steve Carell as the general to be in charge of Space Force. And the Air Force general says, well, we already are in control of space. Space and air are the same thing. And the other general at the table goes, no, there's no air in space. Those are not the same thing.
Well, we have, it was announced and we're setting up a United States Space Force as we speak right now.
Mm-hmm. They were involved in the launch of the SpaceX rocket this week, as a matter of fact. They were the okay. ones who were in charge of recovery of anything that came back to Earth if there was to be some emergency situation. Space Force was the one who was going to recover the rocket or the capsule.
Okay.
Yeah. So we've got Steve Carell in this, Ben Schwartz, who does a great job as the very off-kilter marketing guy for Space Force. John Malkovich is absolutely the shining star of this behind Steve Carell. He is the scientist. He's the one who's really logical, really looking at things from a science perspective and rolling his eyes at Steve Carell's ridiculous statements. Don Lake plays a general who is the secretary to Steve Carell, sitting out in front of his office and just letting anybody in. It's a running gag that that somebody is waiting in Steve Carell's office and the secretary, who is a general, forgets to tell him every time. It was very funny. One of the best parts of this is the fact that it is Fred Willard's last performance before he sadly passed away. Fred Willard plays Steve Carell's father, and he plays a very doddering old man who doesn't understand what's going on a lot of the time. He has a caregiver who's taking care of him, and he says these things in the script to Steve Carell, and Steve Carell is just cringing at all of the ideas that Fred Willard brings to the conversation. It was very funny. I'm not sure it would have been as funny if it wasn't Fred Willard delivering those lines, because they were pretty cringeworthy lines. But this was fun. My wife and I sat down and watched this. We watched 4 hours of it one night, and we're going to get to the rest of it soon. And this, it's silly, and it's satirical, and it's fun, and very cringy. I do suggest this to most people.
Okay. So what else have you watched?
Netflix brought us The Lovebirds this week. This is Issa Rae and Kumail Nanjiani. This was a movie that was supposed to go to the theaters, but since the theaters are closed, Netflix bought it and brought it to us. This is the story of a relationship. Two people who have been in a relationship for 4 years, and they're having some trouble in their love life with each other. They're not seeing eye to eye on some issues. They go out for a night on the town and they get carjacked. And the person who steals their car kills somebody with their car. They are then embroiled in this murder mystery, and they decide that they are going to go investigate why this person killed this other person. And it's just silly, ridiculous. There were at least two times in this where my wife said, this is where you pick up the phone and call the police. You don't go do your own investigation on a murder. You're not Sherlock Holmes. You are two people who are just living your life. This was fun. There's a lot of conversation about relationships and culture and how our cultures work together sometimes and how they are opposed sometimes, and working together is the best way to solve this problem.
You also watched something on Hulu this week. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is a movie called Fast Color. It came out in 2018. It's on Hulu right now. It's a story of a young lady who is on the run because she has superhuman abilities. And when those abilities are discovered, there's a science group that is trying to get her to study her abilities. She goes back to her home where her mother is taking care of her daughter and discovers that the mother has superhuman powers. In fact, there's a whole storyline of their whole family. All the women in their family had these powers, and the young daughter also has amazing powers. And it's a story of family. It's a story of caring. It's a story of finding out who you are and discovering what you can do. I have to say, though, this is really slow paced. This is not a Marvel superhero movie. This is more a symbolic use of magic superpowers to explain about real life situations. And it is a slow film. I don't know that I would suggest that one to everybody.
So is this a series or is this a film?
This is a movie. This is a one-shot, okay, two-hour movie. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's good. It's you just got to stay with it. You can't get distracted by the emptiness of some of the storyline.
All right, and you watched a couple of interviews this week. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting things that's happening as a result of the coronavirus and the fact that we're all stuck inside. Everybody is stuck inside, including those people that we admire. And those people who have done amazing work in the past, they're willing to sit and talk about it because they have a camera, they have a microphone, and they are willing to have a conversation about what they've done. I had the opportunity to listen to an interview with Roger Ebert's widow, Chaz Ebert, and Steve James, who is the director of the documentary film Life Itself, which is the film from the book, the autobiography of Roger Ebert, Life Itself. this was special. This was really great to have the opportunity to hear from Chaz Ebert, to hear about the struggles that Roger Ebert went through in his life. He had all sorts of issues, and she was certainly an amazing part of bringing his life together. And their love, their life together was on display in this movie. And to hear her talk about it, this movie came out in 2014, 6 years ago.
Okay.
To hear her talk about it 6 years later was pretty amazing, pretty special to hear that emotion in her voice, that loss that she still suffers from the loss of her husband, but the joy that his memory brings to her. I like this conversation a lot.
And for those who are not familiar with who Roger Ebert is, Roger Ebert was a film critic. He wrote for one of the Chicago newspapers, and the other newspaper had a person named Gene Siskel. And Siskel and Ebert have reviewed movies on the television, and you know, probably if any market you were in had Siskel and Ebert somewhere. For many, many years, he was like one of the voices for film reviews.
Yeah, and his writing is amazing, and we got into a little bit of that conversation in this interview, but not quite as much as in the autobiography.
Ultimately, he had cancer, and because of that, he lost his ability to communicate through his voice, and his writings on films just took off on a different level at that point. So certainly a very interesting person.
Yeah, and it was really great to hear from Chaz Ebert 6 years after the release of this film, talking about the making of this documentary and talking about the special thing that they had together. Speaking of special things together.
Tell us a little bit about the other interview you saw, Steve.
Yes, totally different interview. I got to see an interview with Bronson Pinchot and Mark Lynn Baker, the stars of Perfect Strangers. Perfect Strangers was a sitcom on TV, Chip.
I didn't watch it, Steve.
I know you didn't, but everybody else in the world.
Is this the guy that was like, "That's ridiculous"?
Yes, that was his catchphrase.
All right, I know who he is.
Balki Bartakamus, that was his catchphrase. Don't be ridiculous. It's the story of two cousins, one from an Eastern European background and one from New York, and getting a chance to be roommates and see the cultural differences and how to get along and how to work with each other. Bronson Pinchot and Mark Lynn Baker are phenomenal together. The two of them had so much fun in this interview. I would love to work with these two men on stage or on screen. Their chemistry is pretty magical, even all these years later.
So tell us some things that you learned.
I don't know if I learned anything in this, Chip. I mean, I learned that they had a lot of fun on the set of Perfect Strangers. They clicked together so quickly. In the audition, Bronson Pinchot, this was Bronson Pinchot's show. They had already cast him. He was the centerpiece. They needed to cast a cousin Larry, and they cast Mark Lynn Baker because in that first audition, the two of them worked so well together. They talk about in this interview how they barely had to finish sentences with each other. They could read each other's minds. They knew what they meant, and they were able to do such silly, funny things on this sitcom. And the director would just go, How did you know that he was going to do that? And he goes, we just knew. We just knew that that's what we were going to do.
Perfect Strangers was aimed at a young audience. It certainly was family entertainment.
Yeah, TGIF was certainly a fun, silly Friday night sitcom piece of television history. Definitely aimed at a younger audience. In 1986 through 1993, I was absolutely the right group of people to understand this. And the fact that I had Eastern European relatives who would occasionally show up, I really got perfect strangers on a personal level. And it was a lot of fun to talk to those guys this week.
How lovely.
You have also been watching things. You caught a little bit of the Jeffrey Epstein Filthy Rich on Netflix.
Yeah, that's a documentary. But as one person commented, this may not, shouldn't be really placed as a documentary. We need to find a different type of word for this. Because R. Kelly and Michael Jackson, they basically had these long series that basically the victims and some of the investigations are placed out there. Would they hold up in the court of law? We don't know. But for those who are not familiar with Jeffrey Epstein, he was a person who was accused and convicted of holding a prostitution ring. Pedophilia was part of it. He had an island that the Clintons had visited, or at least reportedly had visited. So he was acquitted on a number of the charges that were brought against him.
Till he was convicted on finally, ultimately, right?
Well, yeah, and ultimately where this ends is he committed suicide, or at least that's what they allege he did. There are a lot of interviews with, when I say girls, we're talking 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds who were coerced to going to his house and giving him massages, and he would pay them $200. There was enough evidence against them. The police would come and they would raid his place, but the computers weren't there. So it sounds like he's being tipped off. There was a Vanity Fair article that was going to run, and right before it was to be run, they decided to pull it. They felt that they didn't have enough people, even though they had two sisters come forward and tell their story. If you have interest in this subject, I watched Finding Neverland, and you know, once again, it's really hard to believe it. The only challenge I would have in this presentation is, once again, this isn't the court of law. You're getting one side of the story. But yes, the evidence looks so compelling that this gentleman just was a bad, bad person and had a lot of very powerful connections.
Is it interesting storytelling? Are they putting the story together in such a way that it's intriguing?
You're gobsmacked is what you are. Okay. I mean, the whole time you're going, how in the world do we live in this society that allows this to happen? And, you know, you'd think maybe it happens in some foreign country or some area. No, you know, we're in the United States. He had homes in New York. He had in Florida, in New Mexico. I mean, these are American properties. You would think that if something like this was really going on, that it would be caught much more quickly, especially even though he's a very private person, he certainly wasn't an unknown person.
So, yeah, that's a little bit of conspiracy stuff in there. And boy, I don't know what to say about any of it. I am appalled by it for sure.
All right, Steve, let's lighten things up.
Please. You got to see the definitive, oh my goodness, I can't believe that they did that musical, Xanadu.
Oh, good Lord. So, you know, the definitive what? Roller skating movie?
It is the roller skating musical, that's for sure.
All right, the only reason I watched this is I was cleaning up. HBO Max was released this week. I was looking through just sort of what they had. Turner Classic Movies is part of the package for HBO Max. So I flipped on Turner Classic Movies. You're usually thinking Gone with the Wind or some old, old, old movie. This is a 40-year-old movie, though. So Xanadu, I just said, I remember it was really light, and Olivia Newton-John is beautiful. So I flipped it on, and I learned a little bit about this movie. One, the music was very, very good. One side of the record at the time was Olivia Newton-John songs. The other side was Electric Light Orchestra, Jeff Lynne. And the album was very, very popular. Number one songs. So the music was pretty good. I forgot that Gene Kelly starred in this film too. For those who don't know Gene Kelly, the old-time musicals Well, he was one of the guys, along with Fred Astaire. The
dancing legend, along with Fred Astaire. That's right.
That's right. The premise of it was a painter who was trying to make it, had to go back and work for a corporate company painting album covers, and he ran into Olivia Newton-John's character, who was a muse of Zeus, and somehow ran into Gene Kelly, and they decided they were going to make a roller skating rink that was part nightclub, part rock and roll, and part big band. And the Tubes were in this. That's a rock and roll band. They have this crazy dance number where the lead, Olivia Newton-John, and this other guy do this. As I'm watching it, I'm watching how slowly they're skating to Olivia Newton-John singing and Cliff Richard suddenly. There is a Don Bluth cartoon sequence. I didn't remember anything of this film. And it makes no sense. This is like the lightest of the light. It is like a pre-MTV type of music video, but you can see easily where music videos took some inspiration by part of this. This must have been some choreographer's vanity project, because it is, I guess if you had a girlfriend at that time and you're going to go to the movies, you wanted something light and poppy, no one is going to be overly offended by this, but it is just bizarre, and with some good music. What can I say?
And none of the characters in Xanadu are Kublai Khan. Okay, you lost.
And then it just ends. It ends like, sit down, son. You should have a drink. And Olivia Newton-John's character comes over to serve a drink, and they look at each other, and then the music starts playing Xanadu. So there you go. Olivia Newton-John, this was after Grease, certainly was just this wholesome all-American woman from Australia with the Australian accent. I mean,
interesting. It's interesting that that's what you found on HBO Max.
I wanted something light. I wanted just to kind of just see how it worked. And don't worry, this was light. I've since learned this is kind of a cult film. It did not do well. Mm-hmm. Which blew people away, because Grease came out a couple years before it with John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John, and it just blew up. It was so, so popular. They said, oh, we can hit magic again. We'll get all this great music. We'll make this work.
And Gene Kelly.
Oh, and the guy from the Warriors. I mean, it just was... It just was poorly acted. I mean, it's just, the whole time you're watching, you're going... Oh my goodness. Anyway, the house is clean and I got to watch it.
Xanadu.
Hey, Steve, do we have any horror films we can set Stacy up with this week?
Yeah, the first movie on our opening/streaming list this week is called Becky, and this is pretty horrific. I don't know if horror fans would really acknowledge it as horror, but boy, this one looks like if Home Alone was more horrific. A young girl is up in a lake house, and then there's this bad guy who comes in, and she has to run and hide from him.
It's the guy from Grown Ups, right, Steve?
Yes, that is Paul Blart himself, Kevin James. Yes, sir.
So he decided he wanted to go from comedy to like a really, really dark place, Steve.
And you know what? This seems like a really dark movie, and I think it's our pick of the week, because I think that this is the best of the batch this week.
Well, Steve, that's not the only dark film that we have. Tell us another horror film.
Yeah, we've got a movie called Shirley. This is a famous horror writer finding inspiration for her next book after she and her husband take in a young couple. And boy, is there some psychological horror in Shirley.
Well, you know, if The Handmaid's Tale had another side to it, maybe this one would be it.
Yeah, Don't Call Me Shirley.
That was Elizabeth Moss. She stars in this.
Okay. There's a movie called Dreamland featuring, and I'm not kidding, Henry Rollins and Juliette Lewis.
Yeah, I don't think this is Oscar worthy. This looks really odd. What can I say?
I said Henry Rollins and Juliette Lewis. Automatically, that's odd.
All right. Steve, there's a comedy that doesn't look that great. Looks like National Lampoon could have put this on back in the 70s.
Yes, this definitely looks like a 70s sex romp. Sex and the Future is the name of this one. These are two men who design their ideal woman as a robot. They realize a fortune could be made if they had the money to mass produce them. They make a whole bunch of them, and then the sex robots run amok. This is so 70s.
They escape to go into the city to, you know, provide havoc.
And hilarity ensues.
This is, what do you think, like Porky's type of humor?
Yeah, the only thing I can tell you is that Roger Ebert probably would have loved this concept. That's his kind of movie. We'll get back to Roger Ebert in a minute.
All right, Steve, are there any other films that look like maybe they have a really bad Southern accent in them?
There's a movie called The Fox Hunter with a really bad Southern accent, Chip. A foghorn leghorn. I said, son!
The Carolina Times. Well, there is a Raleigh Times. And this looks like a Wes Anderson...
wannabe.
Yeah. Boy, this looks really interesting.
Yeah. There is a very dark take on puppeteering this week called Judy and Punch. In the trailer, it says it is a perfectly plausible origin story to that old-fashioned puppeteering of Punch and Judy. But there are real people involved with this and real domestic abuse. So let's watch that.
Well, Steve, it doesn't get better with the next film.
No, it doesn't. The next one is called Shepherd, the story of a Jewish dog. This is the story of a German shepherd who was raised by a Jewish family.
A boy's dog was taken from him to basically go and be trained to be a killer with the Nazis.
Right. This is another World War II Berlin story where this Jewish family is taken into custody by the Nazis and this dog saves the day? Question mark?
Yeah, let's lighten things up on Hulu, Steve.
Good. We've got the story of We Are Freestyle Love Supreme on Hulu. This is the group that Lin-Manuel Miranda was in before In the Heights and before his superstardom in Hamilton. This is an improv hip-hop group that he was in.
Yeah, it sounds like this is where they were honing the craft and learning how to present information in a rap style that ultimately would be used in The Heights in Hamilton.
Yeah, to great effect in Hamilton, for sure. This is the story of how Lin-Manuel became the Lin-Manuel. I look forward to this one.
Well, Steve, if there was a Michael Jordan of spelling, what movie would we find them in?
Spelling the Dream is hitting Netflix this week. Yes, this is the story of four Indian American students trying to realize their dream of winning the big Scripps spelling bee.
So grab your Webster's dictionary and play along. Steve, is there another film that's coming out?
Yes, there's still more, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us for a minute. The Last Days of American Crime is the story of terrorism and crime. The United States government makes a device that can stop unlawful acts in their tracks. And
it's based on the graphic novel, so you can read about it before watching it. Right. Steve, HBO Max has something for us.
Yeah, I guess they do. It's called I May Destroy You. This is a British story about liberation and exploitation.
It doesn't look like HBO Max is selling it to us, Steve. Tell us, maybe Amazon Prime is going to do a better job.
Well, Amazon Prime is offering us a stand-up comedy routine, Gina Brillen and The Floor is Lava, about relationships in the Midwest in 2020.
Well, the trailer didn't look that great, but hopefully it's better than that.
Yeah, the trailer did not sell it. Book it. Brings us to our book it, our book of the week. I told you that we were going to talk a little bit more about Roger Ebert. The autobiography that Roger Ebert wrote before he passed away was called Life Itself. It was published in 2011, and we talked about it on episode 3 of Too Much Scrolling back in July of 2014.
That was a long time ago, Steve. I had a little bit more hair in my head.
You did. And we only had one microphone, and we were able to sit in the same room together. 2014 was an interesting time. This is a book that I went back and reread this week after listening to Chaz Ebert, the widow of Roger, talk about their life together. And, you know, Roger Ebert was a Midwestern guy. He grew up in central Illinois, and he had a interesting childhood. He grew up, he became a wonderful writer. His writing is stunning. He had his problems in life. He was, you know, that guy who was never going to get married, that eternal bachelor. He partied and went out and drank and became a real problematic alcoholic in his life. But one day he decided that he had enough of that lifestyle and he made a change.
So let me ask some questions. Was he always just a writer, a film critic?
He was a newspaper man. He was a writer. He could write on any topic, but he loved film. Film was his passion, and he accidentally got a job as the film critic. They didn't even ask him if he wanted to be the film critic. They just decided that that's the column that he needed to write one day, and he took that job to the highest heights of that position. He was world known.
Well, along with Gene Siskel, they were the authorities for many, many, many years on that. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. You're saying he was a guy that enjoyed getting around.
Yes, he absolutely had his things that he enjoyed in the world, and one of them was movies with young ladies in them. He loved those 70s movies, those exploitation type movies where there were just naked women for no reason.
And so, well, they were PG at that time. That was certainly very interesting.
So he got involved with one of the directors that he enjoyed his very provocative movies, and he wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which is one of those 70s provocative films. And it's so funny to think of a PBS movie critic, you know, this honored writer, and his idea that he wanted to make this sort of movie is so such a juxtaposition. But Life Itself is a wonderful way to honor who this man was, who he became.
What did you glean from it today that you didn't really grasp when you first read it?
The thing that I like the most about Roger Ebert's story is how much he emphasized empathy, how much he emphasized caring about other people, and how much he saw how we could see other people and other cultures through the movies. The movies are that window into the lives of other people. They might be fictional people, they might be characters, but they're certainly based on real life experiences of the writers and directors who made those movies.
So in this book, does he mention Gene Siskel and sort of their relationship?
Sure, that's a big part of who Roger Ebert was to the public, but most of this book is about who he was to himself, his family life at first, and then his lonely, not finding his people life, and then finding the love of his life in Chaz Ebert, and how the two cultures, her family and his family, came together and made this beautiful bond between them that was not broken by death. She still honors and adores who he was, even though he's been gone for 6 years now. That is a beautiful story. This is a really good autobiography, and that's why I read it again 6 years after we talked about it on episode 3.
Okay.
I do suggest it. It's called Life Itself. You could probably find it in the library nowadays. Well, when the library's open.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. This week is the anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, 1944.
Yeah, D-Day certainly was a day that was very important to basically ultimately winning World War II and bringing peace to the world. I mean, we still, as far as Europe and the rest of the world, are benefiting from the ending of this war. World War I's usually thought the war to end all wars. World War II basically came around and it was even more challenging. But this operation was led by Dwight D. Eisenhower, who eventually would become president, but he was, I guess, the supreme general at the time for that. It looks like that his library, his presidential library, will be holding an event on Thursday, June 4th, called D-Day, What If? And they're going to have a number of historians discussing General Dwight D. Eisenhower's unused In Case of Failure note, where he tells about the invasion of Normandy on D-Day. Normandy is in France, for those who are not aware of that, and Eisenhower's character. For those of you who are not familiar with what was going on at that time, Eisenhower threatened to quit because he was dealing with Roosevelt, who was president at the time, and dealing with Winston Churchill, and he was trying to push through a plan that would ultimately bring the troops, or American troops, along with the other allies, into France and basically start making the push that would ultimately defeat Hitler. If you don't know a lot about this, this is probably a good time to read about it. There's a coronavirus going on, so there's only so many places you can go. You might as well learn a little history and hopefully never repeat something like that again.
Because you can't go to Normandy. I mean, you could, but it'd be pretty challenging to get there. It is, it's a pretty stunning place to visit, I'll tell you that much. It is full of history and full of the ghosts of this battle on the shores of Normandy. It's stunning to think of.
This war was a high cost war, but the benefit of it is what we are experiencing now. And even though there's a number of things going on in the United States that are not supporting it, well, I can say it's brought overwhelmingly peace to the world. The United States Navy basically has secured free trade from who were our enemies at the time. I mean, the world is wealthier now than it's ever been. And unfortunately, we have the coronavirus we get to deal with. And hopefully that will be defeated one day and we can go back to our lives as we knew them.
But until then, every day we should be engaging our minds, right?
We should always learn something. And there's always something to glean from the past that'll help us either think about what shouldn't be or what should be. And there's a good time to think about that right now if you think about the protests that went on last weekend concerning the death of that gentleman up in Minneapolis and how something that I'm sure the police officer regrets happening at this point, but certainly once again highlighted that there are some challenges that we need to deal with. And as soon as those challenges are overcome, we can move forward in this world.
Which brings us to our analysis of A Study in Scarlet from 1887, the Sherlock Holmes story that has so many cultural issues in it. We have got some really great conversations we've been having with Professor Pamela Bedore, and she's walked us through so many of the cultural issues that are in this book.
It's a great time to test your mind. If you're not joining us or haven't joined us yet, if you pick up the book, you can go along with us. And as I'm a new reader to every one of these. Steve has read some of these, and Pam's read some of these, but also is a trained professor on how to break down these stories. And what it allows us to do is have an analysis of them that hopefully you can fall into one of the camps. And also, you can experience those. You know you've wanted to read them at some point. join us in reading them. We're going to be finished with this book in just a couple of days. And after that point, we're going to start reading some short stories again. So you can join along, read the short story, prepare with us. You can send us questions. You want to draw a picture. You want to take a picture. You want us to send us something. We also can share it with all of the other people who are reading it with us. And for those of you who are responding to us and sending us information, we want to thank you for doing that. You've made our discussions even better.
Yep. You can follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes to be a part of the conversation, and you can go to our dedicated website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, for all of those conversations. There's over 60 of them now. We've been doing this for a long time, Chip. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
Yes, sir. Yes, we can. We'll be right back here next week. If you need more information, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
We'll see you in the future.